Once upon a time in the Greek language, there was the word apologia, and this word was a legal term used in the courts. It was the word for defense in the courts. The person who presented such an apology or apologia was the defendant. And the word appears in the New Testament in reference to offering a reason or a defense for the Christian gospel. The word is at the origin of our present-day English word, apology. But obviously the word has weakened considerably in the English language. Earlier in the history of the English language, it had the more powerful meaning. Its weakening has taken place in modern times, so that now, if you apologize for something, you say, gee whiz, I'm sorry, but as a matter of fact, I do believe X or Y. That was not the original meaning of the term. The original meaning of the term was not in any sense apologizing for something, giving an excuse for something, but rather giving a reason or a defense for something. This course is introductory, but it isn't a course designed primarily with the practical object of teaching you how to go out and engage in evangelism. It isn't a practical course in evangelism. It's rather an attempt to give you the theoretical foundations of the defense of the faith, and this is done historically. A good part of the course will be spent showing you how the Christian faith has been defended through the centuries. How, when the Christian faith met certain objections through the centuries, Christians have found ways of answering those objections. Now, that may seem utterly impractical as an approach, but if you think about it for a minute, it can have some tremendous practical implications. As each objection to the faith appeared through history and was answered, that didn't mean that the objection simply evaporated. Instead, some people picked up the objection and used it in other ways later. So as Christian history goes on, the objections to the faith increase in number, and in order to deal with these objections, it's very, very important to be able to know how they were originally dealt with when they were fresh. Generally speaking, the objections as they first appear are dealt with the most effectively. Thus, for example, today we find among the cults the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witnesses claim that Jesus was not God from eternity. He was the first created being. First God created Christ, and then Christ created everything else. That particular viewpoint, that argument against historic Christianity, first appeared in the 4th century among some heretics known as the Arians. And in the 4th century, a great church father by the name of Athanasius gave it to the Arians good. He provided objections to that viewpoint which have never been surpassed. And if you know how Athanasius dealt with the Arians, you have a much more profound basis for handling problems with the Jehovah's Witnesses than as if you simply snuggle up to their tape recorder when they appear on your porch and try to deal with them informally. The point is that the faith has had a long history of defense, and what we want to do in this course is to see how that history is operated and note the ways in which the defense can be of use to us today. If you want something of a more directly practical character, then you may want to get a hold of tapes that I have done under the title Sensible Christianity. These tapes represent lay seminars given in churches around the country, and they are orientated more in the direction of practical evangelism. This is a graduate course. It's a course for people running around with BA degrees or BS degrees who have made themselves objectionable by becoming at least somewhat intellectual. There is a greater expectation on the part of people in a course like this than in the case of a general seminar in a church context. And you'll find that we unashamedly mess about with the positions of various modern theologians in this course. We get into various things that don't seem to be of direct practical relevance in the church, but which are of considerable importance for an understanding of contemporary theology. I say this at the beginning so that you won't be expecting something different from what actually takes place in the course. The situation is that a course that doesn't purport to be practical often turns out to be far more practical than the courses that have the practical object. And if you stick with this kind of thing, you'll see the value of handling it in this fashion. But if that kind of an approach drives you wild, if what you prefer is something along the line of how to do it, that was what you had in mind, then probably you would want to look elsewhere. What we want to begin with tonight is a very brief presentation of why the faith ought to be defended at all. To get the show off on the right wheels, so that you understand the significance of doing this operation at all. Why should people defend the faith? We'll see later on in this first hour that almost all of the major theological positions today don't like the idea of defending the faith. It really makes little difference what theological position you look at today. You find that these positions are not interested in apologetics or are actively hostile in relation to apologetics. So it's worthwhile our asking right at the outset why we should do this kind of thing. And here I want to get you situated in your own time. I want you to be able to understand what kind of a situation you find yourselves in relative to unbelievers. And to do this, you must jump into my handy time machine and go zooming back into the 19th century. Because many American Christians still think they are in the 19th century. So I want you to see the difference between the 19th century and where you are right now. We zoom back into the 19th century. And what do we find? We find here in the United States essentially a religious homogeneity. There is a single religious position represented in the United States in the 19th century. And that single religious position is church Christianity. Church Christianity. Now that Church Christianity had two forms or two varieties. There was what later would come to be called liberalism. And there is what later would come to be called fundamentalism. But these purported at least to be varieties of a single religion, Christianity. You did not have in the 19th century a wide variety of religious options presented or available. Let's see what the early liberals and the early fundamentalists maintained so that you get the spirit of what was going on at that time. The 19th century had as its ideological theme, is the way in which people thought, the notion of progress. If there is one idea that was fundamental to the 19th century, it was the idea of progress. Everything was supposedly coming up, not roses, but progress. And the liberal establishment, what would come to be called the liberal establishment in the churches, reflected that kind of emphasis. At the very middle of the 19th century, Darwin's Origin of Species was published. That's the year 1859. And when the Origin of Species was published, it was reviewed in the New York Times, and the reviewer had this to say. He said, "Darwin has shown us what we already believed anyway, namely that things are getting better and better, and we are rising to higher and higher levels. He has provided us with a scientific foundation for what we were already certain of anyway." And the reviewer quoted Baden-Powell, the father of the founder of the Boy Scouts, and Baden-Powell said, "How much better we can see the deity in order and development than in darkness and confusion." In other words, the notion of evolution fits right in with the idea of God building things up, moving things onward and upward to a positive, progressive goal. In philosophy, the 19th century centers on Hegel. Hegel was a philosophical idealist. He was the great philosophical idealist of modern times. Just about anybody who was anybody who thought philosophically in the 19th century thought in terms of Hegel. There were Hegelians and there were neo-Hegelians, but just about everybody thought in terms of Hegelian idealism. And the essence of Hegel was that in the universe there is a spirit, a world spirit, and this world spirit of reason is carrying us onward and upward to an ultimate goal, the goal of freedom. The great political thinker of the 19th century was Karl Marx. And Karl Marx took Hegel's idealism, his idea of necessary progress, and applied it materialistically. Marx simply took the progressive idea of Hegel and applied it to material things. Said Marx, all of the material factors in history are working so that ultimately a perfect society will come about, a classless society, without the problems of the present. In America, this was the time of big business, the Horatio Alger ideal. And each little Moppet was impressed with the notion that if he worked hard, he could move from office boy to president of the company. It was just a matter of time and a matter of hard work. Darwin's notion of natural selection was applied to the realm of business. Why was it that not everybody became president of the company? Because of natural selection. Some people were naturally orientated toward success, and others evidently were not. And those who were not fell by the wayside. They were the byproducts of a an economic evolution, but ultimately things would come out all right. It's true that there were evolutionary failures, but after all, the end result would be positive, not negative. Everywhere you look in the 19th century, you have this fundamental notion of progress. And many of the churches in America picked up this kind of ideology and made it a part of them. They gave it Christian terminology. They baptized it, if you will. But they took it over nonetheless. It was the position of the liberal churches that Jesus constituted an ideal example. If we imitate Jesus, then we can become like him. Some of them even went to the point of describing Jesus as the evolutionary man. Here you can see man as he ultimately will be. And if we imitate him, then we can attain that sort of thing ourselves. The idea of sin was unfashionable in such churches, because people were capable of attaining the proper goals under their own steam. All they needed was the right kind of example. And fortunately, Jesus offered that. Now, over against that sort of thing, there were churches that came later to be known as fundamentalist churches. And the terms liberal fundamentalist don't really come into prominence until the beginning of our present century, about the time of the Scopes evolution trial. But we see early examples of fundamentalism in the 19th century, certainly. In the 19th century, the kind of emphasis that would later be called fundamentalism is seen in religious revivalism, in the revivals. During the 19th century, the country was expanding westward. The frontier didn't cease actually until 1910 by Census Department definition. There was a frontier, that is, there were very, very few people per cubic inch in large sections of the country, right up to 1910. And in those settings, the frontier revivals continued. These revivals presented Jesus as the answer to people's needs, particularly in the emotional realm. You people watch the late night movies, surely, the old westerns, where the good guys are in white hats and the bad guys are in black hats, thereby eliminating any necessity of critical judgment as to determining what's going on. And in these films, you see the cowboy as a person who works himself and his horse into a lather on the trail for months at a time. He drives the cattle to market, and then after months on the trail, he is ready to whoop it up. And he goes into the little western town and he whoops. And the whooping generally centers upon the saloon. And there all kinds of questionable activities go on. He shoots his wad, he ends up broke, and then he has to go back to the trail again. Now, in contradistinction to that kind of experience, frontier revivalists offered an opportunity for a different kind of catharsis, an opportunity to alter one's way of looking at the world by confronting a personal Savior. And these revivalists presented the gospel of Jesus Christ. They presented it in very simplistic terms often, but they did present that as a genuine alternative to the kind of secular catharsis represented in the frontier towns, in the saloons and the like. But it's very interesting to see that in the 19th century, you don't have among people who are presenting the gospel any real attempt to deal with the progressivism, the liberalism that we've just been talking about. Instead, you have two different approaches to Christianity, very largely. One approach takes the progress idea of the day and baptizes it, turns that into Christianity, and does this with an intellectual cast. At the same time, the people who are presenting the gospel of Christ are presenting it very largely in emotional terms, without attempting to answer or deal with the kind of liberal religion that prevails especially in the urban centers, the cities, in the East. Both of these groups are offering what they claim to be Christianity. You get an ironical kind of situation. The liberals are certainly not presenting Christianity. You can't present Christianity apart from sin and grace unless you see yourself as a sinner and in need of Jesus' death on the cross for your sins. You haven't caught anything of Christianity. Christianity centers at that point. The liberals were not presenting Christianity. But they gave the impression that they were offering an intellectual approach to the faith, and one that fitted beautifully into the spirit of the times. The revivalists were presenting the essence of Christianity, but they weren't presenting it in a way that dealt at all with the kind of liberal perversion of Christianity that was so prevalent. Everybody, however, was supposedly presenting Christianity. If you lived in the 19th century, you would have thought that there wasn't any great need for defending the faith. Defending it against what? If you were a liberal, you would figure that you were in line with the spirit of the times anyway. And so there obviously wasn't anything to defend. Moreover, you would have had a hard time defending it, because it wasn't something for which definite evidence could be offered. It was the spirit of the day. And it's awfully hard to defend that sort of thing. It's like defending a style in women's clothes or a style in hats. It's not an area for defense. It's simply an area for acceptance if you happen to go along in that direction. On the other hand, if you had been a revivalist, you would not have thought in terms of dealing with liberalism, because that was the wisdom of this world, that was the devil's work, and the only task was to catch brands from the burning and to try to do something about the individuals that needed a personal conversion experience. And anyway, there were no other religions being presented as counteractives to Christian faith. You didn't have people trotting around presenting Buddhism in America in the 19th century. There weren't itinerant Muslims offering that option. The cults and isms, as we have contact with them today, were not really in the picture. Toward the end of the 19th century, some of these begin to become prominent. The Mormons appear in the early 19th century and offer more and more contact with the mainline churches toward the end of the century, but not a great deal. Mrs. Mary Baker Glover Patterson... Eddy turns up toward the end of the century, but she also doesn't have a great deal of impact outside of Boston in those early years. So the situation in the 19th century was not one of concern for defending the faith. What went on in the 19th century in the churches was either a capitulation to the lifestyle of the time, as in incipient liberalism, or straight preaching without defense in revivalism. If you'd lived in a small town, and the U.S. was predominantly a small town in the 19th century, there would have been a variety of churches, and you could have gotten into some exciting theological discussions as to whether to dunk them or to sprinkle them, but you couldn't have gotten much beyond that in the context of 19th century religion. That was about the extent of it. Now, look where we are today. You have a tremendous variety of positions within the framework of the Christian church here in the States today. But even more than that, you have a vast number of other religious options, non-Christian religious options, that were not even in the picture here in the United States in the 19th century. We have, for example, a wide variety of cults and isms. Some of these appeared in the 19th century, as we've already suggested, but others have turned up in our own time. We have the influence of Eastern religions. The Eastern religions were practically unheard of in America in the 19th century. They were here in the country in the 19th century, but they were here only in the Chinatowns, being maintained by people who were in Oriental ghettos. Now, these positions are available all over the place. You cannot go to an airport these days without being run down by a saffron-robed fellow with his head shaved. And when you pick yourself up off the floor, you find that bells are being tinkled in your face, and mystic syllables are being repeated in your ear, and you wonder just what is going on. Have you suddenly slipped into the Orient, or what? And so on down the line. We are in a situation today of religious pluralism. Added to this, there is an increasing secularism in modern life, which was very foreign to the 19th century. In the 19th century, when you went to school, you not only got up and pledged allegiance to the flag, but the Bible was read, and doubtless you prayed. The prayers may not have been very profound, but they certainly were a part of the ordinary public school experience. Now, if your teacher attempts to lead you in devotions, she will find herself, chances are, in the courts. She cannot do this. The school prayer decision, Shemp decision of just a few years ago, now states very clearly that a teacher cannot engage in any sectarian activity in the public schools. You can look at this in different ways. Certainly, it is a sign of increasing secularization. At the same time, it's understandable, isn't it? If you were in a Mormon community, you'd be pretty irritated if the teacher put your kids through a Mormon religious experience in the public school. And what the Supreme Court attempted to do in the Shemp decision was simply to make plain that the schools cannot be vehicles for the presentation of a particular religious position. What this indicates is that today there are a lot of competing religious positions. In the 19th century, this didn't come up to any extent. Today, there are enough different positions present that if it were permissible to present religious positions in the public school, the question would be, which one, if you please, which one? So, here we are in a situation of religious pluralism. And because communications have increased, we are bumping up against each other more frequently. In the 19th century, there were many fewer people per square inch. And therefore, even if there were some differences, people weren't standing on top of each other. Now we are bumping up against each other constantly, and different religious positions are in immediate contact. Now, inevitably, under these circumstances, inevitably, you're going to get a situation where it is no longer possible simply to assert that a given religion is true or the final answer. Because there is always somebody else right there ready to assert the same thing about his position. If in a situation of religious pluralism, nobody offers any reasons, the inevitable result is a shouting contest. The question then is, who can yell louder than the other one? I'm sure you have all heard the old story of the clergyman who left his notes on the pulpit. On Monday, when the janitor came through, he was very curious as to what the pastor had written, and so he looked over the notes to the sermon of the previous day, and he found at one point very heavy underscoring, a marginal note, and the marginal note said, "Argument weak here, yell as loud as you can." In any situation where reasons are not given for a position, and there is a diversity of viewpoint, about all that can occur is that the voices begin increasing in decibels, an attempt is made to outshout the other person. This is entirely unsatisfactory. You probably come across that sort of thing in a street context, where the street preacher begins talking louder when he hears somebody beginning to object, and that person begins talking louder, and finally the two are just screaming at each other. Where you get a diversity of viewpoint, and these diversities of viewpoint are in immediate contact with each other, reasons have to be offered. Edgar Sheffield Brightman, professor of philosophy at Boston, used to say, a universe in which both Roman Catholicism and Christian Science can be true would be a cosmic madhouse. Why? Because Roman Catholicism and Christian Science contradict each other. They contradict each other. They both are asserting things that are incompatible with the other. Now, logically, they could both be false, but logically, they can't both be true. And if they can't both be true, how are you going to arbitrate between them? If, of course, you are in a homogeneous situation where the alternative position isn't presented or isn't immediately presented, the problem doesn't come on you in any existential or vital way. You relax. But the minute that the other position does bump up against you and asserts itself, and that position contradicts yours, something has got to be done about this. Something has to be done about it. Now, some Christians have reacted to this by saying, we still can't engage in any argument about this. This is not a question of argument at all. It's a question of personally trying the Christian faith. It's a matter of experientially trying it. And therefore, no matter how pluralistic the situation becomes, no matter how much we come into contact with other positions, the approach is always the same. The non-Christian has simply got to try Christianity, or he'll never know that it's true, and no amount of argument is going to make any difference. There's a certain truth in this, as we'll see later on. But notice that it doesn't really solve the problem. It begs the question, why? Because which position is the non-Christian going to try first? The more positions available, the more difficult the problem. Because everybody is trying to get the uncommitted person to try something. And the people who are already committed are trying to get other committed people to try what they think is right. What do you do in a case like this? Do you alphabetize all of the religions and try them in serial order? If you do, before you get to Christianity, you'll be messing around with Ahmadiyya Buddhism, Baha'i, etc. And it's always possible to become so jaded psychologically from leaping into one or the other of these positions that finally you get to the point where the whole idea of religion turns you off, or where you are so jaded psychologically that you don't know religious truth that comes along with a sign on it. There are people who've gotten into this frame of mind. Ogden Nash has done a hilarious little poem, or tragic, depending upon how you look at it, entitled The Seven Spiritual Ages of Mrs. Marmaduke Moore. It seems that Mrs. Marmaduke Moore, every 10 years, leaps into a new religious position. There is one line in it which says, and with a whoop and a holler, she leapt into the land of the sweet Baha'i Baha'i. That gives you the general lifestyle of Mrs. Marmaduke Moore. Surely, we can't leave the religious question that way. It isn't simply a matter of leaping from one thing to another. Arthur Koestler, the great contemporary novelist, author of Darkness at Noon, has described how it took him 10 years to work himself out of Marxism after he had committed himself to the Marxist philosophy. In a little book entitled The God That Failed, he and a number of other people indicate how they finally worked themselves out of Marxism. For Koestler, this was an agonizing kind of thing. Because when you accept a religion, or when you try a religion, you already are committing yourself to it on some level. And this does something to you personally. It takes a while, and often a bitter and difficult while, to be able to see where the difficulties lie. Depending upon the degree of mental health of the person, this can be a traumatic sort of experience. What we're suggesting is this. Apologetics, at minimum, if it doesn't do anything else, apologetics is essential in order to give people a reason for trying Christianity first. Apologetics marshals reasons, provides grounds for trying Christianity first. Even if you don't want to say anything else in behalf of apologetics, on that level, at least, it becomes vitally important. You want to be able to get people to approach Christ as rapidly as possible. You want people to pray to Him, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. You want to get them to do that in relation to Him before they have become psychologically jaded relative to other religious possibilities. And apologetics offers reasons for that kind of prior trial of Christianity. As we move along, you'll see that I think apologetics does more than that. Apologetics can carry a person to the very threshold of commitment. But even if you don't feel that apologetics ought to have that much of a value, you certainly ought to be able to see that in a day such as ours, it has a vital role to play in helping us in this pluralistic and diverse religious situation. Incidentally, today, the mainline churches have very little interest in this subject. I'm going to talk in just a few minutes about the theologians and the opposition they have to apologetics, but just in general, you find this subject not emphasized in the mainline churches to any extent at all. And I think one of the main reasons for this is the extent to which the mainline churches have picked up some of the attitudes of 19th century liberalism. The mainline churches have pretty well absorbed the attitude of their day toward the meaning of life. They don't approach Christianity as having a specific and objective truth to it. And of course, if you don't look at Christianity as having an objective and specific truth, you haven't got anything to defend. Instead, the mainline churches take other approaches. A few years ago, some canons at St. Paul's Cathedral in London parachuted off of the top of St. Paul's, quote, "to bring the young people back to the church," unquote. They received Esquire's Dubious Achievement Award for that year, and the text of the award read, "If God isn't dead, maybe he wishes he were." The fact of the matter is that in many churches, almost any technique is used to try to get people to come back to the church, except those techniques that relate to the truth of the message. And whenever a church tries to persuade people to join it or to have contact with it for any lesser reason than the truth of the gospel, that church is in real trouble, because the church cannot compete on any other level with the secular society. The church's spaghetti suppers will never reach the level of haute cuisine. If people happen to be interested in gastronomy, the church is not the place to go. If people happen to be interested in recreation, there will be more fun available outside than there is inside. If you're interested in counseling, you can do better with a professional counselor than you can with a half-baked clergyman who's taken a few courses in counseling, etc., etc., etc. The church doesn't exist for all of these extrinsic reasons. These extrinsic reasons are often valuable collateral activities that the church can engage in focusing on the gospel. But these activities taken by themselves will cause the collapse of a church inevitably. And much in the contemporary ecumenical movement consists of churches that have departed from an objective truth view of Christianity, propping each other up because they are falling apart. Ecumenicity is not, as some people think, an activity engaged in on the basis of high purpose in all instances. It can just as well be a matter of the life you save, maybe your own, where churches that are pretty well collapsing because their parachutes are not holding up as they descend from St. Paul's Cathedral, getting together with others in the same plight, hoping that somehow the whole business will keep going. When I was in the Chicago area, there was a very prestigious church not too far from the Trinity Seminary, and this church was in a large denomination that has pretty well lost any conception of the unique truth value of the Christian faith, and which engages in all kinds of other activities besides the preaching or defending of the gospel. And the pastor of it obtained help from a seminary of that denomination for his young people's groups. And unfortunately, he got some very strange birds by this recruiting. He got people whose voices had not changed, and also people whose smoking habits seemed to be more important than their religious habits, and various things of that kind, and he became very discouraged. So he got in touch with the Trinity Seminary, and the seminary sent him some of Trinity's students, and the young people's organization began growing like crazy. The reason for this was perfectly simple. It was because the people from Trinity were preaching the gospel, which never hurts, really, where a church is concerned. When my teaching assistant spoke with this pastor one day, the teaching assistant said to him, "Dr. X, What do you consider the great task of the church in our time? And the pastor said, survival. And that's just about where churches like that stand in the current situation. They are just barely surviving. But the minute that a church takes a New Testament view of the truth value of Christianity, then it invariably moves out and begins having an impact on the society for that gospel. And that in turn puts it into conflict immediately and right off with other viewpoints. And where that conflict occurs, it becomes necessary to give a reason for the hope that is within you. Apologetics immediately takes place at that frontier point, at the juncture between the proclamation of the gospel as truth and other religious positions that come up against it. So the value of apologetics should be immediately evident to anybody who takes a serious view of Christian truth. Well, why then are the theologians, generally speaking, agin it? I want to talk about several theological positions. Several of the main theological positions today, the positions that you come across in your other seminary courses or that you've heard about through reading theological journals such as Time Magazine. Then I want to point out to you what difficulties exist in these positions that lead to their anti-apologetic orientation. I'm going to talk about, first of all, a contemporary Protestant liberalism, then neo-orthodoxy, then a so-called Calvinist orthodoxy. And I put this in quotation marks because if you are a good Calvinist, you will not particularly like this position, will not feel that it is genuine Calvinist orthodoxy, and I'm willing to agree with you if you're nice to me. I don't feel that I have to beat on Calvinism by way of this position, and I know of very good Calvinists who don't take the kind of approach that I'm setting forth here, but it's a position that is very current in some circles. Then I want to talk about existentialism, theological existentialism, and what, for want of a better term, we're going to call Protestant pietism. Each of these positions takes a negative view of apologetics, even though they don't agree with each other. And that's very interesting. Why should they all dislike apologetics? We'll see if we can find out. Let's begin with Protestant liberalism. This is the position that we were talking about before in its full manifestation in the years 1915 up to the First World War and continuing in certain larger denominations. For example, your large city Methodist churches today usually reflect this sort of thing. If you enjoy time machines, just go to any really large, stone, impressive Methodist church in any large city, and you'll be shot back to about 1915, and you'll think you're hearing Harry Emerson Fosdick. It's that sort of thing. And if you don't want to do that, you can go over to the local chapter of the Masons, and you can get pretty much the same sort of thing there. But it's your choice. The essence of the position is that we are basically good. Christ is an example and not a savior, or he's a savior in that he is an example. And that by imitating him, we will lead the right kind of life. The position of Protestant liberalism relative to apologetics was set forth by the dean of the Harvard Divinity School back in the 1930s, a gentleman by the name of Willard L. Sperry, S-P-E-R-R-Y, Willard L. Sperry. He did a book entitled, Yes, But. Quote, yes, comma, but, quote, the bankruptcy of apologetics. Yes, but the bankruptcy of apologetics, done in 1931. And the theme of this book is that we mustn't attempt to defend orthodoxy against the obvious successes of science. There's no sense in defending orthodoxy against scientific discovery. The title of this book is kind of interesting, The Yes But. He's thinking there of people who say to a new development, yes, but we can still maintain the old orthodoxy. What Sperry says is, forget it. You can't maintain the old orthodoxy. You can't maintain a single static view of Christian truth. You've got to change the content of Christianity as scientific knowledge advances. The expression, yes, but theology, originated with an 18th century rationalist theologian named Johann Semler of Halle, and Sperry got this from Schweitzer. Schweitzer, in an early chapter of The Quest of the Historical Jesus, talks about yes-but theology, and so Sperry picks up the idea of yes-but theology, and he uses it to blast apologetics. His view is dependent upon a couple of assumptions. First, and these assumptions are fundamental to liberalism anyway. First, Christianity doesn't have a final, objective truth to defend. There isn't any single, cognitive, objective, final truth in Christianity. Nor does salvation depend upon accepting any such truth. To a liberal, there isn't any fixed Christianity. Christianity is constantly altering in its content, or putting it as they would, we discover constantly new insights into what it really is, and different from what we thought it was previously. And then, a second assumption here. In any case, Christianity isn't qualitatively different from the other world religions. We don't have a situation where Christianity is absolutely true and other religions false, where they contradict Christianity. Not at all. Christianity is like the other religions of the world. Maybe better, and certainly the church liberals thought that it was better, but not in the sense of being true while they are false. After all of the religions teach morality, don't they? And the idea is to imitate Jesus, who gives you a good morality, the best moral example, and then everything will come out all right. Under those circumstances, it isn't necessary to convince others of the truth of Christianity. It's very interesting to see that liberalism was not exactly the foremost missionary operation in the history of the church. We will find as we move along that missions and apologetics go together like love and marriage. You can't have one without the other, says Annie, get your gun. And missions and apologetics go together. Where there is a decline in apologetics, there is a decline in missions. Where there's a decline in missions, there's a decline in apologetics. These two go right together. That comes as quite a shock to some people if they have that notion that the foreign missionary is a kind of Protestant monk and at the top of the status ladder, while the thinker is substituting head for heart and trying to act in place of the Holy Spirit, and therefore is at the bottom of the status ladder. The people who have that notion find it very hard to accept the fact, which is easily provable, that missions and apologetics go together. Malcolm Muggeridge, in Jesus Rediscovered, has the classic line, "I have yet to find a Unitarian leper colony." The classic line, "I have yet to find a Unitarian leper colony," and that is absolutely the case. The fact of the matter is that as you move in the direction of liberalism, you move in the direction of generalizations about humanity and doing good, but you do not find people messing around in at the points of real difficulty, either in missions or in anything else. All right, the liberals then didn't care for apologetics, as we can readily see. What about neo-orthodoxy? After we've taken each of these positions, then we're going to come back and see what the problem is with the assumptions of each. But we want to give as appalling a picture of the dislike of apologetics as we can, and then we'll try to clean it up after we finish doing that. Neo-orthodoxy. Now, neo-orthodoxy was a reaction against liberalism. It's a reaction that took place at the time of the First World War, and the great name is the name of Karl Barth. Karl Barth. You would think that because neo-orthodoxy is a reaction to liberalism, neo-orthodoxy would like apologetics. But that isn't the case. Not at all. The neo-orthodox dislike apologetics as much as the liberals, but for different reasons.